Now, 100 years after the Anglo-Irish Treaty and partition, 30 years, of troubles, the Good Friday Agreement and Brexit, the debate on Irish unity has certainly intensified. And we're mentioning Sinn Féin this morning. If they get into power, which is a likelihood after the next general election, the way the polls are at the moment, they certainly will be pushing for a poll on it all. But what could a united Ireland look like? And what would it mean for those both here and in the north? Frank Connolly is a best-selling author, and he's with me on the line. He's written United Nation, The Case for Integrating Ireland, where he talks to people on either sides and makes some suggestions as to what may happen or should happen in terms of uniting the country. Frank, good morning to you. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Jerry.
Look, it's timely. It's as every week goes by, as every month goes by, the question keeps getting asked as to whether we're closer or not to a poll, whether we're closer or not to the Northern Secretary declaring that the timing is right to ask the question in this country. First question, I suppose, aside from what you wrote about in the book, do you think this is going to happen in the next number of years, that at least the question will be asked of the people both north and south?
Well, I think it has to happen because it's a condition of the Good Friday Agreement that was, you know, cleared by referendums north and south back in 1998. As part of that, there were, of course, two fundamental principles at stake. One was that there would be no change to the constitutional position of the north unless the majority wished otherwise. And the second was that there would have to be, at some point, as you said, when the Secretary of State, the British Secretary of State, decides that such a choice is likely, that a vote would be put allowing people in the north to decide whether they wanted to unify the country and to end the union with Britain. So that's that's something that's built into the Good Friday Agreement. We're now, because of a series of important and significant developments, including obviously Brexit and the vote by the people of Britain to leave the European Union in the referendum in 2016, that has opened up a significant change in both attitudes and in the position, the situation, the actual situation of people in terms of their daily lives in the north in particular, because 56% of people in the north voted to remain within the European Union and to retain European citizenship. And with Brexit, those rights have been effectively nullified. So Brexit has changed the situation significantly. Demographic changes are obviously evident, and the latest census is showing that there's almost a 50-50 between those of a Protestant cultural background or unionist background and of a nationalist background, Catholic background, or cultural background. And that's a significant change. The clear majority of young children attending school, both the primary and secondary age in the north at the moment, are from a nationalist, or Catholic, or cultural background. Those are very, very significant changes. And at the most recent elections, we saw that, again, that figure of 56% of voters supported parties which were in agreement with the Northern Ireland Protocol, which allows the North to enjoy the benefits of trade with both the UK and with the EU. So if you bring all of those factors together, demographic changes, political changes, attitudinal changes, the recent opinion polls are showing a majority, certainly particularly among younger voters in the North, for firstly a referendum, and secondly a clear majority in the most recent Lucid poll in support of United Ireland over the next 10, 15 years or so. So I think the answer to the question is, yes, there has to be a referendum. And in my view, the long-term trends that I pointed out point to a decision to be made within the next number of years. Now, as you've said, that decision is something that will be made by a British government, and of course, the British government will make that decision based on its own obvious interests.
Yeah, they will. Okay, Frank, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back to you because there's other issues to tease out in terms of the opinions and the attitudes that you found when researching and looking at developing this book. We're talking with Frank Connolly. We'll have more with him after we take the. We're talking to Frank Connolly about his book, Uniting Ireland. and talking about, I suppose, the, or United Nations, I should say, the case for integrating Ireland, and talking about what he has found in terms of the timings of it and the people he's spoken to. Frank, can I split things in two for a moment? Number one, how much of an input or how much of a reaction from the people you spoke to talked about the economic side of things when it comes to looking at a new Ireland, how it would work and who would pay for it all?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fundamental question, and I do devote quite a lot of time and attention to that. I've spoken to economists who are already crunching the numbers in respect of how an all-island economy would emerge and how it would benefit the people of Ireland as a single nation within the European Union. That's one very, very important issue. The second one touches the issue of the subvention. So for many years, people were of the view, particularly in the south, that an Irish state couldn't afford the subvention that comes from Britain, from the Exchequer in London,
to support
the public spending in Northern Ireland. And that has been interrogated by a number of people. And again, this book is based on interviews with people who've done a lot of this work, rather than my own opinions.
Sure.
And a number of people, including Professor John Doyle in DCU in Dublin, Dublin City University, has really gone into detail on the actual cost of the subvention to the Irish public in the event of unity. And he's broken it down from a figure that most of us understood at about 10 or 11 billion sterling per annum. But when you deduct the cost of pensions, for instance, that would remain public pensions and other pensions too with the British state after their departure, but they'd still be liable for them. When you take out defence and other spending that's included in that subvention, when you take out the cost of the monarchy, when you take out significant assets, it actually reduces the amount to something in the order of about 3 to 4 billion. And 4 billion is about 4% of Irish GDP. The Irish economy of the south is about 360 to 400 billion. So actually it's not a significant amount in the wider scheme of things. So that's the subvention. Then the issue arises, well, would we be asked to pay more tax, people in the south, taxpayers in the south? What burden would it put on our social welfare system and our public spending generally? All of these issues are examined in the book. Mm. And I think you can't answer these questions unless the research is done. The SRI is doing it. People like Seamus McGuinness and Adele, Seamus McGuinness and his colleagues, Adele, yes, Bergen, among others, have been looking at this in some detail. The NESC is doing this research, and they're actually finding, firstly, that it's important to recognise the North actually has fallen back. It's one of the poorest regions of the UK. Life expectancy is far stronger for people in the South. Per capita income is higher. On all those metrics, the South is a much more prosperous country, and potential is much greater for economic growth. In the longer term, we would save hugely from having a single health administration, a single education system, a single civil service. All of these things
there would be, I suppose, significant disruption to meld the two together, and it would depend as well on what else is happening. If we, had a cost of living crisis or whatever the crisis would be at the time, that would make it a bit more complicated. But I take your point on that. The other question in the time that we've left is possibly the more difficult one, the cultural one. And not to be glib or flippant about it, how do you get Billy Wilson from the Shankill Road to coexist beside Sean O'Reilly from West Belfast in a new Ireland, perhaps with a different flag and a new national anthem?
Yeah, and I've talked to, in this case, Tom Winston in the Shankill Road and Linda Irvine in East Belfast. And these are people from the Protestant Unionist community. And these are people who are open to discussing this idea of how it would work and how would unionists in particular have their identity and their culture protected. And I've got, clearly you're right, that is the most difficult and intractable question. But it's one that unionists themselves are discussing, and among them in the book, as well as people like the former Senator Ian Marshall, Denzil McDaniel, a former editor of the Impartial Reporter in Fermanagh, they're actually arguing that within the unionist community, and not least within the business community and farming communities, there is deep concern concern about the decision to remove them from the European Union and the threat of even abolishing the protocol that's there to protect business. Many business people are quite happy with developing the all-Ireland economy, both on the farming side and in other aspects of commerce and trade. So the discussion is already going on within unionism. I'm not expecting, and I don't think anybody can, the leaders of political unionism, the DUP, and even the UUP, to suddenly say, yes, let's start talking about a united Ireland. It's not in their interest in terms of their survival as leaders of unionism. But within the wider community, as I've said, within unionism, there is a discussion going on, and not least about wanting to retain the benefits of EU membership, yeah, as part of a single country.
Let's focus on the South for a moment, because you mentioned surveys and supports. I remember it was a Vox Pop a couple of years ago, someone was asked, and it's just one instance, a random person was asked, would you be in favour of United Ireland? Yes, 100%, we need to have it now. Would you give up the tricolour? Overnight, over my dead body, was the answer. And I imagine the same would be to Ron Levine. On the other side of it, the sash and the Union Jack and all of those things, the symbolism side. Are you going to be able to get over that? And what about the danger of violence if something is forced on either side?
And I think those are all coming to the simple point that's made in this book and that many other people are making, is that if you don't prepare, if you don't engage in these discussions now, that you cannot have a referendum. You can't expect people to vote when they don't know what they're voting for, and that's what this book is about. Brexit, as we know, was a shambles, and it continues to be. And I think that largely is to do with the fact that people did not know what they were voting for. In this case, you're right. All of those things have to be hammered out. They already are being discussed, as I've said, and I point to many citizens' assemblies that are actually taking place within academic institutions and among younger people in particular in the North, where it's quite open. Nobody should be saying what the national anthem will be in 5 or 10 years' time. We have to discuss those things, and I don't think anything can be ruled out. I think similarly with the flag. I mean, many of us are, you know, we love our tricolour, and that's not going to go away. But we have to find a way of adapting to the needs and interests of others. At the same time, nobody can force people to sing a particular song. Nobody can force people to fly a particular flag. Yeah. And I think these things are workable. And it's not the first time countries have had to deal with the ending a partition
questions.
Arrangements and dealing with these complicated issues.
Yeah, okay, Frank, it's an interesting one. United Nation, the case for integrating Ireland, published by Gill Books. Thanks so much for talking to us in the programme this morning.
Thank you, Jerry.
There you go, Frank Connolly there.